Summer travel season often means road trips on the mainland. With national average gas prices hovering around $2.27, driving to a destination may be both fun and economical. In Hawaii, whether staycationing or visiting another island, we're into day trips. With the state average now at $3.05, some might find that a barrier. And for the growing number of electric vehicle owners, it's probably not a thought at all. This month, the UH Economic Research Organization released a paper on the influence of states' policies on EV adoption in the years from 2011 through 2015. Curious about the actual sales of EVs, we called the Hawaii Automobile Dealers Association to see how changing policies plus relatively low gas prices are affecting Hawaii EV sales. Dave Rolfe is the executive director of the association. Welcome back to the program. Good to talk to you.
Thank you very much.
So you had a look at the UHERO report, too. And one of the things that they said in it is that, you know, states have implemented a range of policies to encourage consumers to purchase EVs, financial and otherwise, but it's unclear how effective these policies are at achieving additional EV uptake. Do you agree with that?
Well, I looked at that wonderful study, and Sherilyn Wee and McKenna Kaufman have been doing some wonderful work there that we often quote their studies and when we testify down at the legislature. And I think it showed that the HOV lane use was something that was very effective in Hawaii. In fact, on their bar graphs, it showed that many people who purchased an EV to get that free parking and the HOV lane use. So that was a driving factor. Not so much the rebate. I mean, that initial rebate that they had in 2011, there were just as many cars that sold the next year without it. So the state rebate didn't seem to have that much effect. The $7,500 tax credit from the feds was pretty nice.
Right, and that's something that's not necessarily still available in that way.
Yeah, right. So that does phase out, and then but I thought their research was superb. They did some special research that I'm still trying to analyze based on the peer concept. If you see your peers buy an electric car, you'll be more inclined to do that.
Well, you know, we see that in a lot of marketing campaigns where, you know, you see a driveway and two cars in it, and one person is looking at their car with love and admiration and a great deal of self-pride, and the other person is looking at their car thinking, I could have had one of those. But really, how true is that when we look at actual sales? That's a little bit tougher to measure. You do have actual, you know, figures, though.
Well, I do recall former Governor Cayetano purchased a Volt, which is a plug-in hybrid electric. His wife purchased a Vic Cayetano, purchases the same thing just right thereafter. So you saw two in the driveway, and I've known a number of couples that have two Leafs in the driveway. It's all based on this old theory called the Rule of 250 by Joe Girard, and he was an old car salesman who. Well, if I can explain it, it takes about a minute, if you don't mind. He noticed that when his daughter was getting married, he went to buy the box of cards to send out for his daughter's wedding. And he said, why do they come in boxes of 250? He said, well, in this area, that's what, you have about 250 friends. His father died a couple years later, and he noticed there the box of thank you for attending the funeral were 250. And so he came up with this rule since he was a car salesperson. He said, gosh, if you do something nice for somebody, then 250 people will know about it, the rule of 250. So I used that in determining all our charts for the adoption of the electric vehicle. I said, once you got to 4,000 sold and on the roadways, that's a 1/250th of all the million cars on the road, that would kind of reach that critical mass moment. And sure enough, that started up until we hit the gas situation. And you noticed that dampened all the electric vehicle sales.
That said, you also told me a few years ago that you believe that we'd have softer gas prices for several years.
As far as the eye can see.
Yeah, and that I'm being conservative here. And that would be a great impetus for people to buy a new car, likely a standard car, not necessarily an EV.
A bigger vehicle with attributes.
Right, mm-hmm. But we still feel this pressure from many different areas, people who feel they want to do something better for the planet, better for their neighborhood, get better mileage, whatever it may be. That tends to push people, and maybe that is some of the peer pressure too, to potentially look at an EV. Have you seen an upshot in EV sales in any great dramatic proportion?
Well, they haven't damped it as much as we thought because of the lower gas prices, because we anticipated those low gas prices 8 years ago, where everyone else said it's going to go to $200 a barrel. We said, oh, no, it won't. It'll stay, we said, $80 plus or minus 20% for as long as we can see. It's even far less than that, actually. We didn't anticipate all that fracking activity. But that will be the case, and so the EVs will have to kind of overcome that, and we'll see how that goes. But the EV is a big part of the future here in Hawaii, and it's because we're this perfect petri dish for experimenting with the EV and the hydrogen car. And we've got great public policy, HOV lanes, free parking for the EV, and lots of attention toward it. So we'll see. You know, EVs have been popular here about twice the uptake rate than the rest of the country.
How many do we have on the road now?
A little over 5,000, so that's a pretty big number. I always thought 4,000 was the magic number, but again, it hasn't taken off quite as fast. You see the Teslas coming more and more into play, and their numbers are starting to fill up a lot of the EV uptake. Nissan has a tremendous offer on their Leaf right now. And so many of the car manufacturers have EVs coming out, from Volkswagen to Mercedes to BMW, and a lot of them are the plug-in hybrid type. And so I just think every manufacturer has an EV on the books or coming out or has one already.
You mentioned that you think that it's going to be a very big thing for us here in Hawaii. At what point do you think that will be where we see more than just, you know, 5,000 or 6,000 of them out on the road?
Three things have to happen. First of all, you have to have the barrel tax, that money dedicated all toward renewable energy, and it's not. Most of it's carved off and put into the general fund. So when the auto dealers backed the barrel tax, it was with the understanding that that money would be used to promote renewable vehicles, but fundamentally it's not. Only a small portion of it is. Second thing, we're not a ZEV state, a zero-emission vehicle state, so it's kind of hard to get the vehicles sometimes. And we opposed being a ZEV state because we didn't want a patchwork quilt across the rest of the country. It's murder on the manufacturers to say, I can sell some cars in some states and some and not in others. And so rather than go along with that whole problem of patchwork, we said, hold the line here. Let's either all be ZEV or none be ZEV. So we'd be happy to be a ZEV state. But anyway, that has to be solved. And then finally, you have to have this massive education of the public campaign, something that this is very helpful right now, this discussion. We thought it would be about a $3 million campaign. That's what a governor's campaign used to cost in the old days. When you would bring out all the benefits to Hawaii of keeping all that gasoline money that goes offshore here circulating in our economy, well, that's pretty phenomenal.
We're going to wait and see how this begins to roll out. You've been right about a great many things, Mr. Dave Rolfe. We'll see what happens with this, too. Thanks very much for coming in with an update on what's happening with EVs. Dave Rolfe is the executive director of the Hawaii Automobile Dealers Association. The group represents 135 new car franchises in the islands and has coordinated dealer-related public policy input related to the introduction of electric vehicles and hydrogen fuel cell electric vehicles in Hawaii. In 2011, Dave Rolfe developed and implemented part of the public education component of the state's EV Ready grant program.
Baby, you can drive my car. Yes, I'm gonna be a star. Baby, you can drive my car. And maybe I love you. Beep, 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 yeah.
This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, well, we're going to talk a little bit about brain health and dementia. But first, a look at your backyard quiz. As many of you look forward to picnics and weekend snacks ahead, we're going to test your knowledge of foodie history. Now, for today's quiz, we're scooping out an island staple that was originally, or I should say, scoping out an island staple that was originally introduced by Chinese plantation laborers in the form of char siu bao, which literally translates into skewered roasted bun. In the early 1800s, Hawaiians called these buns mea ono pua'a, which means a delicious bread pastry made with pork. Chinese heard the word as manapua. The word is unique to Hawaii and refers to any bun filled with meat or sweets. Traditionally, char siu bao are steamed so that fully cooked, the dough plumps up and is white in color. The idea of baking the bun is a Western cooking concept, and the buns come out of the oven a golden brown. Can you tell us the name of one of the first manapua shops in Hawaii to sell the baked version of char siu bao, and is one of the original tenants of the Cultural Plaza in Honolulu's Chinatown? If you know, call us at 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. And if you're right and first, you'll get the prize.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk show programming. Mahalo to contributors Bush Consulting, Sacred Hearts Academy, and Urgent Care Hawaii.
Few issues of aging can be as frightening for a patient and a family as the prospect of a diagnosis of Alzheimer's disease. Hawaii has the highest longevity, and the likelihood is increasing that more families will get that diagnosis. The way doctors view Alzheimer's has changed in the past 6 years because the guidelines for Alzheimer's dementia has also changed. Yet many people who hear Alzheimer's and dementia see them as the same thing. We asked Dr. Kamal Masaki, chair of the Department of Geriatric Medicine at the John A. Burns School of Medicine, to explain the difference between how dementia fits into the continuum of Alzheimer's disease as opposed to dementia that may occur for other reasons.
Basically, dementia is sort of the umbrella diagnosis. Dementia means having a problem with your memory, with your thinking, and even your functional abilities. You know, it affects all parts of your life. One of the types of dementia, the most common type, is Alzheimer's disease. But there are other types of dementia as well. For example, having strokes can cause dementia. Having Parkinson's disease for many years can also lead to dementia. And there are many, many other conditions that can cause a dementia state as well. Alzheimer's tends to be the most common, though.
On that continuum of Alzheimer's disease, we talk a lot about the things that we can see, the things that we experience as families if we're coping with a member who happens to have Alzheimer's or another form of dementia, but especially for Alzheimer's. What about the time before we begin to see some of these symptoms? Are there ways of being able to check for biomarkers? Is there a way for families to find out more in advance what may be happening with a loved one?
Yes, there is. There's a lot of research going on right now in that area, actually, because we really want to try and find this diagnosis as early as possible. However, in clinical practice, it's usually these tests are not usually recommended. They're more a research tool at this time. I do recommend, though, that people over the age of 65 ask their physician to do just some simple memory testing at least once a year. And of course, if there's any kind of concern, if they or if their family members notice that there are any problems, then to go and get a more complete evaluation. But we don't recommend everybody going and getting tested. There are some markers that happen. You know, the changes in the brain for Alzheimer's disease in particular start even decades before the person presents with the clinical illness. So they're there. But what we recommend to people is just to be very aware, and for even family members to be aware, and for physicians to be aware. We're doing a lot of physician training to try to make sure that they recognize the early signs of Alzheimer's and other dementias.
Which I can imagine would be tricky, and I can imagine also that people listening to this would say, well, if you have the ability to see if there's a biomarker, why not try to test for it earlier on to be able to be forewarned?
So I think the main reason right now is we don't have a cure or even very effective treatments for Alzheimer's disease. There's a lot of research being done in this area. If at any time we do find a cure, I think for sure everything will change. I think for sure we'll be trying to find the diagnosis much earlier so we can do a lot of preventive measures. But at this point, what I recommend to most people is just kind of live your life, do all the things that we know are good for brain health. Anyway, whether or not you have these markers, because I think that's good for other parts of your body as well, plan for your life, make your advanced healthcare directives, have a durable power of attorney for healthcare, because you never know what's going to happen. It's not just Alzheimer's. There are other things that can happen that could rob you of those abilities. Mm-hmm. So I tell people to just go forward and plan, but I don't think they should excessively worry about dementia.
What I hear you saying is that if everyone were to go out and get tested, that there would be a lot of people who might short-circuit their lives because of a biomarker that might be found that might, in fact, rob them of many years of very productive life.
Exactly. That's exactly right. Now, and there's nothing that we could really do differently for those patients at this point. Again, if we find something that's very effective at either preventing the disease or at curing the disease in early stages, I think that all of this will change.
You mentioned a little earlier about people who are over 65 would be well advised to have their doctors give them, you know, simple tests. What is it that you would advise them to do, and how does that look different, perhaps, if somebody is highly productive but very stressed when, you know, things can happen, you can forget your keys and be 30 because you're thinking about something else?
Of course. Of course, those little things happen to all of us. You know, all of us have little lapses in memory, but they don't really affect our functioning. I think the times when you have to worry is when it does start to affect your functioning, when you're no longer able to interact with your friends and family, when you're no longer able to keep your job or function well at your job if you're still working. That's when you really need to be concerned. One of the hallmarks of Alzheimer's disease is that there's a lack of insight. So the patients themselves will not even realize they have any problem at all. So often it's people around them who bring these things to the doctor's attention. Because the patient, when you ask the patient with Alzheimer's, how is your memory? The most common answer is, my memory is great. Because they have no insight that there's a problem.
So what would be a really good indicator to a family member that, in fact, there is a problem and it needs to be considered more carefully? What would you say to someone?
There's a very good handout on the Alzheimer's Association website. It's called the 10 Early Warning Signs. So I would recommend that people who have any concerns, you know, kind of look at that and see whether their loved ones have any of those signs. I wouldn't recommend that people make the diagnosis on their own. It's really important if they have any concerns at all, just to take it to the person's physician.
Of course, but for people in Hawaii, to give some context to this, because we're always told the statistic that, you know, 1 in 10 Americans over the age of 65 mm-hmm. will have Alzheimer's disease. But in terms of Hawaii stats, we are such a long-lived population. We have a different lifestyle here. Does that impact the numbers?
It certainly can. But our numbers are also growing. So currently, we have 27,000 people in Hawaii who have the diagnosis of Alzheimer's disease or another type of dementia. However, this number is going to increase by about 30% by 2025. It's projected that we'll have 35,000 people with this diagnosis. I want to also caution you that I think there are many other people who are not diagnosed. Some studies, including a couple of local studies, have found that up to 2/3 of dementia is undiagnosed. Even physicians can miss it unless they're very specifically looking for it. So I think what we're actually seeing is the tip of the iceberg. This is really a public health crisis right now.
Especially in a state like ours where we are known for such longevity and the fact that you've got people who are easily in the middle 60s to middle 70s who are still working and still want to be functional contributing members and in many cases have the economic necessity to do so.
I agree. That's absolutely true. The other thing that we have in this state is we have a lot of people over the age of 85, and that's where the rates of dementia hit almost half. And again, because our numbers in that age group are so large, I think we will see an increasing number of people struck with this disease.
Which is to say it's not going to be a matter of just the person who will be dealing with it, whether they're aware of it or not, but this will become a family crisis.
This does become a family crisis. Most of the care given to patients with dementia is given by family caregivers. And, of course, that's unpaid care. So many, many people are given care by their family members. So sometimes the family members actually have to take early retirement, or some families are juggling between aging parents who have dementia and young children with both parents working. So it becomes a very tricky issue for families to take care of these patients.
As you look at the horizon of what is being researched now, and clearly this is your specialty and what you're involved with, mm-hmm. how hopeful are you that we will see some real movement in the direction of at least being able to perhaps find some way of, if not just slowing the disease, but being able to cure it?
I'm very hopeful. I think finally the government is putting in a lot of money into Alzheimer's research. And so I think there is a lot of work going on. The other thing we really stress to people is to try and do some preventive things, which should not start in old age. They should really start in middle age. So one of the things that studies here in Hawaii and others have found is that a good lifestyle in middle life, so for middle-aged people to take care of themselves by controlling their heart disease risk factors, things like high blood pressure, diabetes, obesity, lack of physical activity, smoking, if people can take care of these, that definitely reduces the risk of having dementia many years later when they are in old age.
Well, let's hope that we take that advice to heart, literally, and that we have less of what may be forecast, because that's going to be a difficult thing for many people here. We are so far from everywhere, and so many families will be so compromised. Thank you so much.
You're very welcome.
Dr. Kamal Masaki is professor and chair of the Department of Geriatric Medicine at the John A. Byrne School of Medicine at UH. Tomorrow on Oahu and twice next month on Maui, AARP is offering workshops for families coping with Alzheimer's and dementia. The annual Aging in Place conference will happen on August 19th. And for more information about all of that, you can check our Facebook page, The Conversation. The head of Hawaii's Aquatic Resource Division says he's not sure lawmakers, quote, knew what they were doing when they passed a bill phasing out aquarium fishing. DLNR is urging Governor Ige to veto the bill. Politics and opinion editor Chad Blair at Civil Beat has today's reality check. Hi there.
Happy Friday, Beth Ann, and thanks for the plug.
Oh, well, you know, that's who we are.
Sounds good.
We've had such a long-standing and contentious issue with this, and this goes back years. This is not just something that came up this time around, but this time around we did see this bill come out. I can imagine that the governor is getting it from both sides, especially as his veto list is expected on Monday.
You know what? An update just came over the transit. He's actually going to announce, the governor, his vetoes early. He's got a press conference scheduled for 1:30. We'll be there. And, of course, this is one of the bills that we've been following closely. You and I were just talking about this the other week, and Nathan Eagle has reported on, is this aquarium fish bill really necessary? Is it just a feel-good bill to make people think, oh, we're saving the fish and protecting the environment, or is it really even necessary? And now Bruce Anderson, who runs the Aquatics Division at the Land Board, saying, no, you don't need to have this bill. He's weighing in literally at the last minute trying to sway the governor. His boss, Suzanne Case, opposed this in testimony, saying, look, culling fish from our waters is not having a negative effect on the environment.
I mean, didn't he say there was no data to show that the aquarium industry is having that negative effect?
Yeah, there's none at all that he can see. It's really fuzzy. Now, you have others on the opposite side, like the Humane Society, saying, look, we think there's actually significant declines in the population of aquarium fish. We believe the reefs have been devastated. But then the counterargument is, well, wait a minute, reefs are being devastated by all sorts of things like runoff, global warming. And where are you getting the exact numbers? There's really only one section of the state, and we talked about this, where we really are paying attention to the aquatic life, and that's on the west side of the Big Island. That's where most of the aquarium fish are caught. I'm thinking about yellow tang in particular. Everybody likes to have those fish. But no, there's no data elsewhere, not very little on Maui, on Kauai, none at all on Oahu. So, you know, why pass this bill is the argument coming from Bruce Anderson.
And yet the other side has been saying for years that you're not just talking about the damage to the reef and the damage to, you know, the fish themselves, but that it reflects on us how we're willing to treat all of these resources.
Yeah, that's a good argument. Here's yet another counter argument. Isn't it nice to have aquarium fish, you know, for your kids, for your family to maybe grow to respect and understand, appreciate our aquatic life by having an aquarium in your household? By the way, there's another argument that has come up. Westpac, the Western Fisheries Organization, they've been meeting in Honolulu all week. And one of their executives this week said, wait, if this bill passes, is this going to lead to banning all fishing? I don't think that's going to happen.
That might be hyperbole at this point.
But having said that, we have talked about the very serious concern about overfishing. Of course, we're talking about commercial consumption, and there is a serious concern there. So these are the kind of things EGA is going to have to weigh. In many ways, it's going to come down to, do I be popular or do I take the tough decision?
Well, you know, we're from what you told us just a little while ago, now we're not even going to have to wait over the weekend.
Yeah, we're going to find
out early, so we'll have more to talk about and get an answer to this one, too. Thanks, Chad.
Thanks, Bethann.
Every day we bring you a reality check from Civil Beat, today featuring politics and opinion editor Chad Blair.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Hawaiian Paddle Sports on Maui, providing sustainable eco-tours with a dedication to using business for environmental and social change. HawaiianPaddleSports.com.
Well, it's a Friday, and it's time to read your letters and email. This week on our talkback line, we heard this after Tuesday's segment with Dr. Colette Brown about older women facing more economic challenges and also about the Haleakala Sunrise Summit visitation conversation that we had with Lynette King.
Aloha, this is Kathy in Lahaina, and I have two comments about two segments. The first one was about the situation for single women over 65. It seems to me whenever I hear talk about income and work, it always has to do with training people to be employees instead of to being business owners. America is known as a very creative country. We should be teaching people from a young age how to start their own businesses. Then on Haleakala, the number of visitors up there, in Hawaiian culture, that's a very sacred space. We have to make many more stronger efforts to limit the number of people that are up there at once. It needs to be respected more. Thank you, and have a great day. Aloha.
Following yesterday's town square on the acceleration of global heat waves, Katie Kasora from Hilo wrote, I'm curious at what level of temperature and humidity are dangerous for island residents. August 2015, exclamation point. Concerned with children and construction workers and others having to work in those conditions. And Peter Kafka called in to share that he is, quote, not keen on the repeat of the conversation. News is old and no longer relevant at 7 p.m., and he cannot call in. Thank you all for the comments. You can send in yours to talkback at hawaiipublicradio.org. Reach out via social media on Facebook or Twitter, or call our talkback line, 792-8217. I've seen better days dripping down your face. We don't have to talk, let's dance. For the times you felt alone, dreaming better, I see better. By now you likely know that Hawaii has a mandate to reach 100% renewable standard by the year 2045. How the state can get there while injecting positive economic growth was the focus of this week's Verge Hawaii Asia Pacific Clean Energy Summit. The three-day conference was sponsored by community convener Green Biz in partnership with the State Energy Office. Joel McCower is chairman and executive editor of Green Biz Group. He's on the line now with some of the bigger issues that attendees took away. Hi there.
Aloha.
Yeah, over 3 days, you have a lot of time to be able to talk and to listen and to hear and to see how these various groups of people that you convene through the Verge Conference are interacting with each other. Sometimes it's a surprise that people who have interests in common or that would have interests dependent upon each other are actually in the same room. Did it take long to get this group together to actually sit down and listen to itself?
Well, I think this is a group that wanted to meet. I mean, one of the reasons that we've partnered with the State Energy Office to do Verge Hawaii was because this mandate is, you know, relatively easy to commit to, pretty hard to actually pull off. And to do that well, not just technologically in terms of implementing all the, you know, solar and wind and biomass and all these other energy sources, and technologically integrating them into the grid and in a way that does not interfere with the grid. It's also about economics. It's about the cultural issues. It's about ensuring that these technologies are made accessible to everybody in Hawaii, not just those of well-to-do and businesses, and that we're respecting the cultures and traditions that make up the state. And so, and then there's universities and healthcare and, of course, government agencies at every level from cities and counties up to the state, and not the least of which is the military, which, of course, has a big presence there. And we had speakers there from PACCOM, the U.S. Pacific Command, and the Navy, and a number of parts of the military who are already figuring some of these things out. So the challenge is, first of all, getting everyone in the room and then having a conversation. And once they're there, they really get into it. They really wanted to talk and share.
All right. Well, let's take some of that apart a little bit, because here we are and we say the time frame of 2045, and it sounds like it's so far away, and yet it's fewer than 25 years away, and you blink and you're kind of there. We're only about a quarter of the way into that, aren't we, in terms of that renewable energy mandate?
Yeah, and it's happened, you know, fairly. It's gone from 9% to, by the end of last year, it was 26%, and that's good. And according to Governor Ige, who addressed the conference, said they're ahead of schedule to hit 30% by 2020, but that still leaves 70% to go in just 25 years, and it's hard. I mean, as the expression goes, you picked the low-hanging fruit. You've done the sort of relatively easy things in terms of the buildings that are, at least many of the buildings that are you can easily put solar panels on and things like that. Now come the harder things, and so that's really a lot of what we talked about.
So let's talk about some of those more difficult things, because you're right. You know, the easy stuff has been accomplished, but that still leaves the vast majority that we've yet to do. What are the more difficult things, and in what order would you see them?
Well, first and foremost, it's efficiency, which is not about renewables, but putting in renewables without putting in efficiency first. In other words, using the least amount of energy you need is like having a Diet Coke with your double bacon cheeseburger and calling it a balanced meal. You have to, or calling it a diet. you really have to do the basics first. So number one is use the least amount of energy it takes to do what needs to be done. And that's not just things you plug in, but it's vehicles. It's every type of energy in the state. And then number two is, you know, figure out there's still a lot of buildings. If you just look around Honolulu or Waikiki or, you know, the big touristy areas, there are a lot of buildings that don't yet have solar. There's still a long way to go. So the tip of the spear has been, you know, out there and doing these things. But there's a lot of building owners and some government agencies and others that can certainly jump in. And so, I mean, those two things alone will get the state much further, much faster.
I want to just bring us back a little bit to something you said a little earlier in the conversation, where you were really starting to move into the area of energy justice, that as all of this begins to happen, that we don't lose sight of the importance of engaging local and indigenous cultures, the Hawaiian culture, to be able to make sure that, that we're not having it disproportionately borne by those who are the least able to.
Right. We had a terrific panel the other day with a woman named Rose McKinney James, who's who's been a very active leader in energy justice, Vien Trong, who heads Green for All here in California, and Talonda Baker from the University of Hawaii at Manoa, talking about these issues and why energy and climate justice are so critical. Of course, the effects of climate change often hit and energy and environmental issues often hit those at the lower ends of the economic spectrum first. They tend to be the ones that live near either power plants or processing facilities, recycling facilities, you know, things like that where there's dirty, a lot of trucks going through with diesel fumes. And so it's, we cannot do this if this is not done for all, if we cannot figure out how to engage the communities and make sure we're doing it in a way that's not just respectful culturally, but economically fair, and that's a big challenge, and that's certainly not unique to Hawaii. It's being that's a challenge that all over the world we're seeing. Most states and countries that have clean energy commitments are dealing with.
Joel, we've got to go in just about a minute or so, but I don't want to leave you without asking you about tourism, because it seems like tourism industry hasn't really gotten any skin in the game with this, or bought into the idea that we have this mandate. What do we do?
Yeah, right.
How do we bring them into the whole idea of engagement?
That's a big challenge. I mean, we had a sustainable tourism summit during the 3 days on Wednesday, and brought together the airlines and the electric companies and the Hawaii Tourism Authority, and it's just at the beginning of a conversation. It's going to continue. We'll continue it next year at Verge Hawaii 18. They need to be part of this, and they don't necessarily see it's a little bit of time to get into it, but ironically, the tourism industry does not fully see how sustainability it connects to the tourism industry. And of course, most of us outside would look at and say, well, Hawaii is all about the environment, and we need to care for that. And so the 100% renewable energy mandate, connecting that to the tourism industry is going to be one of the big hurdles ahead.
I want to thank you for giving us a real overview of what happened over the last 3 days, and we'll look forward to talking to you again and seeing how this plan begins to move forward and how these groups that have come together are actually hopefully working together towards some of those objectives that you outlined. Thanks so much.
I look forward to that. Thank you, Bethann.
Joel Makaur is chairman and executive editor of Green Biz Group, creator of greenbiz.com, as well as research reports and events on the corporate sustainability strategy and trends. He hosts the annual Green Biz and Verge conferences around the world and is the principal author of the annual State of Green Business report. Well, we're coming up to a weekend. We're going to get to some of the fun events that you might want to put into your schedule in just a minute. But first, we're going to get to the answer to today's backyard quiz. Now, earlier we were indulging in one of Hawaii's favorite foods, manapua. These tasty buns are easy to find. They're sold in many local bakeries, convenience stores, and restaurants throughout the state. Usually, they're steamed, but today we asked you to name the manapua shop that was one of the first to begin selling the baked version of this bun. Now, if you said Royal Kitchen, you hit the steamer off the stove. Opened in 1974, Royal Kitchen has been feeding local appetites for over 37 years, offering baked manapua with a variety of fillings, including char siu, curry chicken. Well, you know, lots of great stuff that's probably making you a bit hungry about now. Now, we want to thank Roger Lau for this tasty bit of trivia, and also to our winner, Kehau Palama, who called in from Kona, who knew the answer. She said she grew up in Honolulu and enjoyed many a Royal Kitchen baked manapua. Thanks so much for playing the Backyard Quiz. And if you've got a question for us, you can always send it in to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from Achieve 3000, wishing all students, parents, teachers, and administrators an enjoyable summer, providing opportunities for student summer reading with Achieve Hawaii Home Access. Achieve3000.com/Hawaii.
Sometimes it's tough to keep track of all the activities going on throughout the state. Morning Edition host and colleague Derek Malama does his best. Today he's here with some of the events going on in our community that might be a little under the radar. So today, Derek, where are you going to take me to?
We'll go to the Big Island first. National Historical Park there. Pu'uhonua or Honaunau celebrates its 56th anniversary tomorrow and on Sunday. The festival is called Kala Hiki Ola, an extension of life, and it's a philosophy in which traditions are renewed for the next generation. So on Saturday, there are games, arts and crafts, and canoe rides. On Sunday, games, arts and crafts, a hukilau, and Hawaiian food tasting. And the festival is from 9 to 3 on both days at Pu'uhonua o Honaunau National Historical Park, and it's free.
That's a good part of that, too. Now, take us all the way back to Oahu and out to Hawaii Kai.
Yes, a free event in Hawaii Kai tomorrow celebrates music and Hawaiian culture tomorrow. The Hawaii Kai Town Center holds its Mele on the Marina Festival, and this family event starts at 3 with slack key guitarist Dayton Watanabe. A hula halau performs at 5, and Uncle Jerome and the Makaha Sons take the stage at 6 p.m. Plus, they'll have food booths and food vendors, and this is free.
All right, very quickly, you got one more for me?
Okay, classical music concert this Sunday at Chaminade University. The Hawaii Vocal Arts Ensemble presents the 30th Annual Hawaii Vocal Masterworks Festival. Ooh. And this concert is at 4 p.m. in the Mystical Rose Oratory at Chaminade. For ticket information and more about this concert, go to our website.
All right. Well, you might be able to do a little bit of the one in Hawaii Kai and then slip over there to Chaminade.
Sure, whatever you want.
It's going to be a nice day. Thanks so much. And we appreciate it. Derek Malama joins the conversation to take a closer look at some events that might be going on in our community, kind of under the radar. You can always find a whole lot more at our website, hawaiipublicradio.org. Okay, I have a confession to make about this next segment. I've known my guest since she was a teen toting an ukulele. From those days until now, Taimani's brilliance as a performer has continued to grow and draw a devoted following. Last year's success at her Element show at the Hawaii Theater also brought her new insight about her career and what she wanted to do with it. In a few weeks, she'll head off to the mainland on her Western Winds tour, but first, she's with us. Hey there, darling. How are you?
I'm good. How are you doing?
Nice to have you here and to see you move and grow in the way that you've been doing over the last many years. But especially, I think, last year just became that point, that seminal point of departure where we saw your career move in a much more, I don't want to say just professional way, but a much more mature one.
Yes, I really have to give it to my new manager, Mark Tyrone. And we actually started working together towards the Hawaii Theater debut. That was my first time working with him, and ever since, he's really, worked his butt off, and it's been great. Yeah.
When you look at sort of that arc of your career that has led you to this point, a girl toting an ukulele out there playing and doing so much around Hawaii and being very well known here is a different story than someone who's on a very different stage, both national and worldwide. How do you view women in music, particularly in some very non-traditional ways or ways that we're really not used to seeing so much?
Especially with the ukulele, I find it's being innovated in so many different ways. And no matter what the gender is, the ukulele is growing. And it is nice to see young women taking these instruments and really jamming out. It's pretty amazing to see the woman really coming into her own in her masculine energy, but also keeping that feminine energy. And I did just see Wonder Woman, and so I it's nice to see this powerful
it's
energy.
Effect.
It is. It's nice to see both sides in women, but also in men.
When you perform, you don't seem any less feminine. In fact, far more so. And given the poster for the tour, it's a very feminine, very strong mm-hmm. image of you, very different from what we've seen before, which was a little softer, mm-hmm. a little more watery, if you will. I want to have you play a little bit for us, and then we're going to talk some more.
Sure. Well, that's funny that you said watery, because this song is called Water, and I hope you hear the different aspects of water. It's like a 6-minute song, so I'll stop it right there.
Okay, well, we can do another taste of something else because we have time.
Oh.
What would be a different mood if that were water? Mm-hmm. What's something else?
This one is called Air.
Lots of it breathing in this room. It's also lovely, and you have so many moods. This, of course, coming from your Elements concert last year. Mm-hmm. What have you done very recently that would be indicative of how this is a departure for you in going off to the mainland for the Western Winds?
Very good question. I'm really excited. I'm going to be releasing the Elements as an album. But this tour is going to be different because I get to bring my guitarist and my cajon player, and it's going to be fun to be able to travel with my unit. I'm going to feel a lot more of a foundation and being able to express more of myself with my backup. It's going to be a fun tour, and I'm going to give more of the Taimani experience.
And how do you define that Taimani experience? Oh. I mean, we all have our own ideas of it. Particularly those of us who have known you since you were smaller, but how do you define it for yourself?
Very good question. I'm very feisty, but I also like my music to be emotional in different ways. It can be technical, it can be simple, but ultimately I want people to feel something through my music.
Most people do walk away feeling something and looking at you almost in awe that you're able to perform in this way. But mm-hmm. now you're also talking about performing with not just your own group, but other people, too. How does it feel to be involved with people who have been on a very different level of performance in their past careers?
Ultimately, collaborating with different artists keeps it interesting for me. And being able to be on stage and sharing that energy with someone performing with me, but also getting that from the audience is really what I live for.
So tell some of the people you're going to be performing with.
I'm going to be on tour with Michael Franti in July, and we are starting off at the Red Rocks in Colorado, which I hear is beautiful, and then we're off to the Gorge Amphitheater as well in Washington. So I'm very excited to be in front of that amount of people, but also with Michael, who has been ultimately almost like an uncle. We're both barefoot, so, you know, we like to jump around a lot.
That's going to be fun to see. It's going to be a really good experience for you, too. Well, I tell you what, while we say goodbye to you for the moment, we're going to do a couple of little things, and we're going to have you back to play us out. So stay right here. Stay with me. Ukulele Virtuoso Taimani will launch her Mainland Western Winds Tour in just a few weeks. For our full tour schedule, you can check our Facebook page, The Conversation.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the National Kidney Foundation of Hawaii, whose Kidney Cars program provides funding for community health and education services. Learn more about vehicle donation at kidneyhi.org.
That's going to do it for us for this week. Coming next week, former New Zealand Prime Minister Dame Jenny Shipley will be in town. She'll be adding her experience to a conference on women's empowerment. And urban planner and community organizer Wyatt Gordon has a different take on the pricing of Honolulu's new bike share program. And Chris Vandercook will be returning. Meanwhile, you can always call our talkback line and leave us your comments about anything that you've heard on the show. Here's the number. It's 808-792-8217. You can also email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org or find us on Facebook at The Conversation or on Twitter at HI Conversation. If you want to tweet me, I'm at BKOZHPR. Lillian Song produces the program, and Ryan Finnerty and Amber Kahn are our production assistants. The Backyard Quiz theme was written for us by John DeMello. And many thanks for the live music from Taimani, who's going to play us out. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. Join us on Monday and pick up the conversation. Have a great weekend.